More than a decade ago, 12 jurors in Orlando, Florida delivered a verdict that sent shockwaves across the country. In a packed courtroom, watched by millions, Casey Anthony was found not guilty of murdering her 2-year-old daughter. For many, it felt impossible. For others, it was proof that the state hadn't met its burden. But when the verdict was read, the story didn't end. Only the criminal trial did. Because in the years that followed, new pieces of this case continued to surface. Digital evidence that jurors never heard about. Civil lawsuits filed by those who said they were misled. Explosive affidavits from insiders. Convictions overturned on appeal. A new law passed in Kaylee's name. Polygraph examinations. And eventually, Casey Anthony herself stepping back into the spotlight to tell her version of what happened inside that house on June 16th, 2008. So what did the jury not know? What was discovered after the courtroom lights went dark? And if certain evidence had been presented, would 12 jurors have decided differently? Today, we're stepping beyond the verdict, beyond the headlines, and back into the details that continue to divide a nation. The prosecution says she chose a social life over motherhood. The defense says this was a tragic accident covered up by a dysfunctional family. But it's the jurors who have the final say. This is the 13 Juror Podcast, where we break down real court cases and put you in the juror's seat. Two sides, the same evidence. You decide what to believe. I'm your host, Brandi Churchwell. Today's episode is Florida versus Casey Anthony, Part 3, Beyond the Jury Box. This case was already a national spectacle long before a jury was ever seated. It dominated headlines and cable news across the country. But when trial began, it detonated and became something even bigger. During the defense's opening statement, jurors were confronted with explosive allegations of sexual abuse, claims no one outside the defense team had publicly heard framed that way before. In an instant, the narrative shifted. What had been a prosecution centered on lies and forensics became a courtroom drama layered with accusations of generational trauma and family betrayal. But what jurors didn't realize was that behind the scenes, there was significant litigation surrounding those allegations that unfolded outside the jury's presence. Much of that legal battle never reached the jurors who would ultimately decide Casey Anthony's fate. Before trial, defense attorney Jose Baez signaled that he intended to argue that Casey's history of alleged sexual abuse by her father explained her pattern of lying and her behavior in the aftermath of Kaylee's death. The state challenged the relevance and admissibility of those claims, and the judge ultimately ruled that while the defense could reference the allegations in opening statement as part of its theory, they would not be permitted to argue them as established fact unless supporting evidence was introduced during trial. Since the defense team was unable to provide independent corroborating evidence to substantiate the assault claims, the court prohibited defense from revisiting those allegations during closing arguments. As a result, jurors heard the accusation, but they were not given additional testimony, documentation, or expert evidence to evaluate it further. The issue became part of the broader post-trial debate. Whether the allegation was a strategic narrative introduced to create reasonable doubt, or a deeply personal claim that never received full evidentiary exploration outside of a courtroom. When the case was finally handed to the jury, the media frenzy had reached a fever pitch. News trucks lined the streets. Reporters packed the courtroom. Journalists later said they could hear helicopters circling overhead as the world waited for 12 jurors to decide Casey Anthony's fate. Judge Belvin Perry Jr., who presided over the trial, later said that when he received the verdict form, he was stunned. He read it once, then read it again, possibly to make sure he was seeing it correctly. And when the words were spoken, not guilty on the charge of first-degree murder, the backlash was immediate and overwhelming. Reporters described a roar of outrage erupting from the courthouse plaza below. The sound was so loud, so visceral, that it carried upward, audible even 25 floors above, inside the courtroom where the verdict had just been delivered. The end of the criminal trial did not mark the end of Casey Anthony's legal battles. Although she was acquitted of murder, jurors convicted her on 4 misdemeanor counts of providing false information to law enforcement. Since she had been in jail for 3 years awaiting trial, Casey was sentenced to time served and probation. But 2 years later, in January 2013, a Florida appellate court revisited those convictions. The case made its way before the 5th District Court of Appeal, where judges were asked to consider whether Casey should have been convicted 4 separate times for lying to detectives, or whether she should have just been charged once. After reviewing the evidence and arguments from both sides, the judges agreed that 2 of the 4 convictions should be set aside. They concluded that charging her multiple times for lies made during the same interview sequence violated double jeopardy protections, meaning she could not be punished more than once for essentially the same act. Under the court's decision, some of the false statements Casey had made were improperly charged as separate crimes rather than grouped together as part of a single offense. As a result, only 2 of her misdemeanor convictions actually stuck. The court also rejected Casey's argument that her statements should have been thrown out because she had not yet been read her Miranda rights. If the court had agreed with this claim, even the remaining convictions could have been overturned. However, the judges determined that she was not in custody legally, meaning the Miranda warnings were not required at that time. This appeal didn't change Casey Anthony's overall legal outcome. She had already served her sentence, but it did alter the official record of her convictions. And for some of the civil cases that followed, particularly those tied to her false statements, the reduction in convictions carried legal weight. Because the stories Casey told to police, to the media, and to the jury would follow her into civil court. One of the names repeated more than any other during the investigation and trial was Zanny the Nanny. When Casey first spoke to police, she provided a full name, Zenaida Fernandez Gonzalez. She described her car. She listed the names of her children. At trial, Casey's defense team admitted that the kidnapping story was fabricated. What jurors did not hear in detail was this. Zenaida Fernandez Gonzalez is a real person. And the children's names Casey gave, they were real. The vehicle description, accurate. But when investigators located and interviewed Zenaida, they determined she had never met Casey Anthony and had certainly never babysat Kaylee. So how did Casey know those details? Zenaida lived in Kissimmee, Florida, in neighboring Osceola County. She confirmed that on one occasion, she and Casey had been at the same apartment complex on the same day. After touring a unit, Zenaida filled out an application card that included her name, the names of her 2 children, and the vehicles they drove. Authorities later determined that the information on that application matched the details Casey provided to law enforcement when she accused Zanny the Nanny of kidnapping Kaylee. Once the media began broadcasting the nickname, Zenaida said her life changed overnight. She claimed she became the target of intense public outrage. According to her lawsuit, people believed she had kidnapped, even killed, Kaylee Anthony. She reported losing friends, her job, and her home, and even received death threats. Zenaida filed a defamation lawsuit against Casey Anthony, alleging severe emotional distress and reputational harm. During a lengthy deposition that lasted roughly 12 hours, Zenaida was questioned about the damage she said she had suffered. As she left the proceeding, she told reporters she simply wanted her name cleared, and she wanted closure. Casey was also deposed in the civil case, but she invoked her Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination for many of the questions posed to her. In September 2015, a Florida judge ruled in Casey Anthony's favor, concluding that Zenaida had not met the legal threshold required to prove defamation. Another lawsuit came from a scuba diver who had volunteered in the search for Kaylee. He claimed he spent hours searching alligator-infested waters based on Casey's claims that her daughter was missing. He alleged fraud, arguing that Casey knew Kaylee was already dead and that the volunteers like him were risking their safety based on lies. He later dropped the suit, but Texas Equisearch did not. Texas Equisearch Mounted Search and Recovery, often referred to as TES, had entered the case with a single purpose: to help locate a missing child. In the summer of 2008, they traveled to Central Florida, bringing volunteers, equipment, search grids, boats, and resources, all funded through donations. For days, teams combed wooded areas and waterways and followed tips generated by Casey and her family. Volunteers searched swamps, believing a child might still be alive. But according to TES, their efforts were built on false information. The organization later alleged that Casey's kidnapping story, particularly the narrative involving Zanny the nanny, directed search resources toward areas that had no connection to Kaylee's death. They argued that Casey knew Kaylee had been dead since June 16, 2008, yet allowed searchers to continue looking for a child she knew would not be found alive. TES claimed it was not until the criminal trial that they understood the extent of the deception. In response, Texas Equisearch filed a civil lawsuit against Casey Anthony, seeking reimbursement for the costs they said were incurred because of her false statements. The amount sought was approximately $100,000. Casey ultimately reached a settlement with TES, but recovery of those funds became complicated. Casey filed for Chapter 7 bankruptcy protection, a move that significantly limited creditors' ability to collect outstanding judgments. As a result, the likelihood of TES recovering the full amount remains uncertain. For TES, the lawsuit was never framed as simply a financial dispute. It was about accountability, about the cost, both literal and human, of false information in a missing child investigation. It served as another reminder that while the criminal jury had rendered its verdict, the consequences of Kaylee Anthony's disappearance continued to ripple outward into civil courtrooms, into volunteer organizations, and into the lives of those who had tried to help. The final major civil dispute following the criminal trial came from a man whose name became permanently tied to the case, Roy Kronk. Kronk was the utility worker who, in December of 2008, discovered Kaylee's remains in a wooded area less than half a mile from the Anthony home. His 911 call led authorities to the site where the skeletal remains, blanket, and bag were recovered. But in the years that followed, Kronk himself became the subject of public suspicion. During the criminal trial, defense attorney Jose Baez suggested that Kronk's multiple calls to law enforcement about suspicious objects in the woods, months before Kaylee's remains were officially recovered, raised questions. The defense implied that Kronk's timeline was inconsistent and suggested the possibility that evidence may have been moved. Those insinuations never led to charges against Kronk. He was not arrested. He was not accused by prosecutors of wrongdoing. But the implications aired in open court and on national television damaged his reputation. Kronk later filed a defamation lawsuit against members of Casey Anthony's defense team, alleging that statements made about him during the trial falsely implied he had been involved in Kaylee's death or the handling of her remains. He argued that as a result of those claims, he lost his job and faced harassment and public scrutiny. The lawsuit was ultimately dismissed. A judge ruled that statements made by defense attorneys during trial were protected under litigation privilege, meaning attorneys are shielded from defamation claims for statements made in the course of representing their client in court. For Kronk, the dismissal meant there would be no civil remedy. And like the other lawsuits tied to this case, it illustrated how far-reaching the consequences were. The searchers, the bystanders, the people pulled into the orbit of a case that captivated the nation. Even after the verdict was read, the fallout continued. After the verdict, when the headlines faded and the courtroom lights went dark, several jurors reportedly went into hiding amid public outrage. Most refused to speak publicly, but two eventually explained something that stunned many observers. They said the state couldn't conclusively prove how Kaylee died. The medical examiner had ruled the manner of death was a homicide, but the exact cause of death was undetermined. And for those jurors, that uncertainty mattered. They struggled with it. If they didn't know how Kaylee died, how could they know Casey was responsible? For many watching from the outside, there seemed to be more than enough evidence. The lies, the behavior, the month-long deception, the chloroform searches. But it wasn't until a year after the verdict that a new piece of evidence surfaced that many believe could have changed everything. At trial, jurors heard about internet searches for chloroform on the Anthony family computer. The prosecution argued that those searches supported their theory that someone had researched how to incapacitate a child. The defense pushed back, suggesting the evidence was exaggerated. Cindy Anthony even attempted to take responsibility for the chloroform searches, despite work records showing she wasn't at home at the time. That was the digital evidence the jury heard. But here's what they didn't. On June 16th, 2008, the last day Kaylee was seen alive, someone logged into the password-protected Anthony family computer at 2:49 p.m. Both George and Cindy were at work. From that computer, a Google search was entered. Foolproof suffocation. The word suffocation was misspelled, but the phrase itself was unmistakable. Foolproof suffocation. Not days later, not after Kaylee was reported missing, the same afternoon. The search never made it into evidence. The Orange County Sheriff's Captain later confirmed that the search was recovered from the computer, specifically from the Mozilla Firefox browser, which had not been fully analyzed before trial. Investigators had primarily extracted Internet Explorer history, overlooking more than 1,200 Firefox entries from that day, including this one. Records show that after typing foolproof suffocation, the user clicked on an article discussing suicide methods, including poisoning and suffocation with a plastic bag, details that closely tracked the prosecution's theory of this case. The existence of the search became widely known after defense attorney Jose Baez referenced it in his book, Presumed Guilty. Baez suggested that if the search occurred, it could have been conducted by George Anthony, possibly in the aftermath of an accidental drowning, even contemplating suicide. But aside from George having already left for work at the time of the search, digital logs also show that shortly after the suffocation search, the user accessed MySpace, a site Casey frequently used, and George did not. When the sheriff's office later reviewed the records at the prosecutor's request, Orange County Sheriff Captain Nieves acknowledged the oversight. The specific keyword, quote, foolproof suffocation, had not been requested during the initial forensic extraction. So it was never flagged and never turned over before trial. Lead prosecutor Jeff Ashton later called the omission a shame, adding that it certainly would have put the accidental death claim in serious question. And remember what the jurors said. They struggled with not knowing how Kaylee died. They struggled with the absence of a clear mechanism. Now imagine sitting in that jury room and hearing that on the very afternoon Kaylee disappeared, someone in that home searched for a foolproof way to suffocate. Would it have proven murder beyond a reasonable doubt? No. Would it have identified who typed it? Not conclusively. But would it have changed the tone of deliberations? Would it have made the accidental drowning theory harder to accept? That question still hangs in the air. Once the appeals were finished and the civil suits complete, things seemed to calm down for a while. But this case has never truly gone quiet. Every few years, it resurfaces in documentaries, interviews, televised specials, each one promising new insight, new answers, or a new theory about what really happened inside that house. And with each reemergence, the same question lingers. Did the jury get it right? In recent years, both George and Cindy Anthony agreed to participate in televised documentary specials revisiting the case. For the first time in years, they sat down on camera to answer questions. And then came the part designed to settle lingering doubt. Both George and Cindy agreed to take polygraph examinations. For many viewers, it was framed as a moment of reckoning, a test of credibility, especially for George. The questions were direct. Did George Anthony have anything to do with Kaylee's death? Did he help cover it up? Did Cindy? For years, George had been living under a cloud of accusation. Now, according to the polygraph examiner featured in the special, both George and Cindy showed no signs of deception in their responses. The results were presented as indications that neither had been involved in Kaylee's death or in concealing it. Now, it's important to say this clearly. Polygraphs do not measure truth. They measure physiological responses, things like heart rate, blood pressure, and breathing patterns. The theory is that deceptive answers will trigger stress, and that stress will show up in those bodily responses. But stress is not the same thing as lying, and lying is not the only thing that can cause stress. In fact, the scientific community has long criticized polygraph testing. The National Academy of Sciences concluded that the overall evidence supporting polygraph accuracy is scant and scientifically weak. Because of these concerns, polygraph examinations are not generally admissible in court. They are considered investigative tools, but not scientific proof. Despite the pseudoscience, in the court of public opinion, lie detector tests can carry emotional weight. For some viewers, the results reinforced what they already believed, that George and Cindy were grieving grandparents who had been dragged into a nightmare not of their making. For others, the tests changed nothing. In late 2022, Casey Anthony finally broke her long silence on camera in the three-part Peacock docuseries, Casey Anthony, Where the Truth Lies, speaking publicly for the first time since her acquittal. In the series, Casey acknowledges she is, in her own words, a convicted liar. And she admits she lied repeatedly. She addresses Kaylee's paternity, acknowledging that she told her ex-boyfriend he was the father, even though she knew that wasn't true. Casey claims she did so because she genuinely did not know who Kaylee's father was. She says she was sexually assaulted at a party and, as a result, was uncertain about the child's paternity. Then Casey offered her most detailed version yet of what she says happened on June 16, 2008. According to Casey, she had gone to lay down with Kaylee, but was woken up by her father at some point, telling her Kaylee was missing. They began to look for her, and she claimed she came outside to find her father, George, standing near the family pool with Kaylee in his arms. Casey said Kaylee was soaking wet, and George handed Kaylee to her and said it was all her fault, that she caused it. Casey described Kaylee as heavy, cold, and unresponsive. She said George did not attempt CPR or call 911. Instead, she claims she collapsed while holding her daughter, terrified and unsure what to do. She said he took Kaylee from her, and he immediately softened his tone and said, "It's going to be okay." She said she wanted to believe him because she wanted her to be okay. Then he took her from Casey and went away. Casey claimed she intentionally misled police, not for self-preservation, but to protect her father after that day, saying she was brainwashed into lying. She described herself as numb, broken and confused, yet somehow still clinging to hope, believing there was a chance Kaylee might still be okay. Casey maintains she still does not know how Kaylee died, but insists the child could not have climbed into the family pool by herself and suggested possible involvement of her father. In the documentary, Casey advances another disturbing allegation. She suggests that George may have staged Kaylee's death to appear as an accidental drowning. To support that theory, she recounts her claim that during her childhood, her father would enter her room and abuse her, and that if she resisted, he would hold a pillow over her face until she lost consciousness. Casey then speculates that something similar could have happened to Kaylee. George Anthony has repeatedly and unequivocally denied this account. There's no physical evidence placing him at the pool that morning in the way Casey describes, and the jury did not hear this specific narrative in the form she now presents it. The documentary also revisits Casey's increased social activity after June 16th, including social media posts and perceived party behavior. Detectives highlighted this pattern to argue Casey was frustrated that Kaylee's presence limited her social life. She claimed her deception was rooted in fear of her father, fear of not being believed, fear of confronting what had happened. Casey reflects on her infamous Bella Vita tattoo, describing it as a subconscious reaction to her family situation and not a celebration of life during the time Kaylee was missing. In the documentary, Casey repeats allegations that were first raised at trial, claiming her father sexually abused her between the ages of 8 and 12. She also alleges that she later confided in her brother and that he mistreated her during her teenage years. Her family has consistently denied those accusations. Throughout the series, Casey discusses the psychological toll the case has taken on her, including how she compartmentalized traumatic events and frames many of her past actions through that lens. More than a decade later, the story is still evolving, depending on who is telling it. The jury rendered its verdict in 2011, but in documentaries, interviews, and renewed public debate, the case continues to be retried, not in a courtroom, but in living rooms across the country. Years after the trial, new court filings surfaced in connection with Casey Anthony's bankruptcy proceedings. Inside those filings were sworn affidavits from a private investigator named Dominic Casey, a man who said he briefly worked with the defense team in 2008. In those documents, Dominic Casey made a series of explosive allegations. It's important to say this clearly. These claims were never proven in court, and they were strongly denied by those accused. But because they were filed under oath in federal bankruptcy proceedings, they became part of the public record and part of the extended story surrounding this case. According to Dominic, when Jose Baez hired him in 2008, it was not to find Kaylee alive. It was to find her body. Dominic alleged that Baez told him Casey had admitted she killed Kaylee and disposed of her body, and that the goal was to locate the remains before law enforcement or anyone else did. That allegation, if true, would have fundamentally changed the narrative of the case. But again, it is an allegation contained in an affidavit, not a finding by a court. Dominic further claimed that once Kaylee's remains were discovered, discussions began about how to frame a defense theory. He alleged that Casey wanted others implicated, including Roy Kronk, the man who found Kaylee's remains. Dominic also claimed that while reviewing photographs of the Anthony home, he noticed that the above-ground pool ladder had been left accessible, and he is the one who suggested the possibility of an accidental drowning theory. Perhaps the most sensational allegation in his filings involved Jose Baez personally. Dominic claimed that Casey Anthony and Baez had a sexual relationship, and that Casey paid for portions of her legal defense with sexual favors. In his affidavit, he described alleged encounters he said he witnessed and claimed that Baez exerted significant control over Casey. In one particularly graphic allegation, Dominic claimed he once entered the office and saw Casey leaving Baez's office naked, later saying she was paying legal fees through sexual acts. These claims were widely reported. Jose Baez responded publicly and unequivocally denied them. He stated that he never admitted Casey was guilty, never had a sexual relationship with her, and called the allegations absolutely 100% false. Baez also questioned Dominic Casey's credibility, and the legal system weighed in too. A judge later sanctioned Dominic for failing to appear at multiple court-ordered depositions related to these allegations. Portions of the filings were struck or sealed, limiting their legal impact. No criminal charges resulted from these claims. No court has found them to be true. But they remain part of the broader post-trial fallout, another layer of controversy in a case that refuses to stay settled. More than a decade after the verdict, the legal case is over. But the divide inside the Anthony family remains. Cindy Anthony has spoken publicly in interviews and documentary appearances over the years. She maintained that Kaylee's death may have been accidental, consistent with the defense's theory that Kaylee drowned in the pool. Cindy has suggested that something terrible happened that day, that Casey may have panicked, and that the lies that followed were born out of fear rather than malice. In her view, Casey knew she could not revive Kaylee, and everything spiraled from there. Cindy has acknowledged the damage caused by the lies, but she has indicated that she does still have occasional contact with her daughter. George Anthony's position has been markedly different. In interviews, George has rejected the accidental drowning theory outright. He described it as, quote, a bunch of bull. He has said he does not believe Kaylee drowned in the family pool. George has also spoken out about what he described as unusual behavior in the weeks leading up to Kaylee's disappearance. He said that Kaylee would sometimes sleep for unusually long periods, 10 to 13 hours at a time, and that she occasionally had dark circles under her eyes. George has publicly wondered whether Casey may have been using some form of sedative to make Kaylee sleep. He has speculated about medications that could have been attained socially, including Xanax, sometimes referred to as Xannies, a detail some observers have connected symbolically to the nickname Zanny the Nanny. George has said that the damage caused by the allegations raised during trial, particularly the claims that he sexually abused Casey and helped cover up Kaylee's death, severed the relationship beyond repair. He does not speak to Casey. Cindy and George remain in the Orlando area. After her acquittal in 2011, Casey Anthony largely withdrew from public life. For years, she lived in South Florida and worked for Patrick McKenna, the lead investigator on her defense team. McKenna has publicly defended Casey and stated he believes in her innocence. Reporting indicates Casey worked as a legal assistant and researcher for him for several years. In 2020, she filed paperwork to create her own private investigative firm, Case Research and Consulting Services, LLC, though there is little public information about the business and whether it truly took off. She also briefly attempted to work as a photographer, but reported harassment and online backlash that made that difficult. In 2022, public reporting confirmed she was still working for McKenna. In late 2024, Casey returned to headlines after tabloid reports claimed she had been involved in a relationship with a married man and had relocated to Tennessee. The reports indicated the relationship ended shortly afterward. Then, in March of 2025, Casey resurfaced again, this time on social media. She launched a TikTok account, branding herself as a legal researcher and advocate. In her introductory video, she stated that she planned to create content on Substack and social platforms to advocate for herself and for her daughter. Since then, she has live-streamed, interacted with followers, and weighed in on legal and political issues, including calling for investigations into high-profile law enforcement incidents. Her return to public discourse has reignited strong reactions. For some, it is an exercise in free speech. For others, it is a painful reminder of a case they believe ended without justice. Casey Anthony has not been charged with any new crimes related to Kaylee's death. Civil judgments, including those connected to Texas EquiSearch, remain complicated by her Chapter 7 bankruptcy filing. More than a decade later, she remains one of the most polarizing figures in modern criminal history. In the wake of the verdict, public outrage didn't just spill into protests and petitions. It moved into legislatures. Across the country, lawmakers began introducing bills inspired by one central question. How can a child be missing for 31 days and no one be legally required to report it? That question haunted lawmakers and became the foundation for what many began calling Kaylee's Law. The idea was simple: create criminal penalties for failing to report a missing child within a specific time frame. In Florida, lawmakers introduced legislation that would have made it a felony for a parent or caregiver to fail to report a child missing within 24 hours. The proposal gained national attention and widespread public support. Ultimately, several states passed their own versions of Kaylee's Law, creating criminal penalties for knowingly failing to report a missing child in a timely manner. Supporters argued that such laws would close a gap exposed by the Anthony case, where, at the time, there was no specific statute making it illegal to delay reporting a child missing. Kaylee's Law became part of a national conversation, a reminder that even when a courtroom verdict brings a case to a legal close, its social and political impact can ripple outward for years. For many, it was a way to ensure that Kaylee Anthony's name would be associated not only with controversy, but with change. Before we close this chapter, it's important to come back to the center of it all. Kaylee Marie Anthony, a little girl with bright eyes, a crooked grin, and a laugh the people who loved her say could fill a room. A child who didn't choose any of this. A child whose life ended long before she had the chance to become who she might have been. When we talk about this case, so much of the focus shifts to Casey, to the lies, to the parties, to the forensics, to the verdict. But at its core, this case forces us to confront something deeper: our expectations of parenthood. We have an instinctive understanding of what a mother looks like when her child is missing. Panic, desperation, urgency, sleepless nights, public pleas, raw emotion. That expectation shaped how the public saw Casey from the beginning. Her behavior, the smiling photos, the nightlife, the tattoo, felt incompatible with the role people believe a grieving mother should occupy. But this case also forced us to take a look at other forms of parental response. Cindy Anthony taking the stand and attempting to shoulder responsibility for internet searches that weren't hers, offering explanations, creating context, trying to protect her daughter, even in the shadow of overwhelming public anger. That, too, is a version of parenthood. Defending your child, sometimes at great personal cost. And then there's George, a former law enforcement officer who testified about the smell of decomposition, a grandfather who organized searches, a father accused in open court of unimaginable acts, a man who has publicly rejected the drowning theory and has said the damage done inside that courtroom fractured his family beyond repair. Whether people believe him or not, his life, like Cindy's, was permanently altered by what happened. In different ways, each embodied something about parenthood: protection, denial, confrontation, loyalty, fracture. But through all of it, through the theories, the lawsuits, the documentaries, and the appeals, there is still a little girl who never got to grow up. The legal system rendered its verdict. Appeals were filed, laws were passed, public opinion remains divided. And yet the questions linger, not just about what happened, but about truth, responsibility, and the fragile line between perception and proof. However you view the evidence, however you interpret the behavior, however you reconcile the verdict, the one thing that remains unchanged is this: Kaylee deserved to grow up. She deserved safety. She deserved a future. And in remembering her, maybe the most important thing we can do is refuse to let her become just a headline or a courtroom exhibit or a cultural flashpoint. Whatever we believe about the adults, we should never forget the child at the center of it all, the little girl who deserved more than this story. Thirteenth Juror is an Audio Chuck production, hosted by Brandy Churchwell. Ashley Flowers is executive producer. You can follow 13th Juror on Instagram at 13th Juror Podcast. I think Chuck would approve.